I will now give the floor to Kenneth Haar, who will tell us everything we need to know about the fiscal compact and maybe economic governance that is currently high on the agenda.
I will give it a try, at least. Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me. Yeah, well, as Angela said, I work with a group called Corporate Europe Observatory, and mainly it's our business to keep track of big business lobby organizations in Brussels. The reason why we started working on the euro crisis was mainly because about 2 years ago, we started discovering that a number of reforms were on the way, were being adopted in the European Union. The kind of reforms that big business had been yearning for very, very long. And those reforms were very much legitimized by the ongoing euro crisis. So that was in the beginning that was our take on it, and we saw it as our role to reveal that and to disclose that. I'm going to cover quite a lot of ground in my presentation. I will really do my best to be as precise and concise as possible. I guess there will be some time for clarification afterwards if some of it's unclear. I'd say I have 3 points on my menu. First is, I think it's necessary at a meeting like this to start with a brief introduction to what caused this crisis. Basically, what we are discussing is the EU response to the crisis, and I think it would be worth it just to say a few words about what's reality and what's myth, in my view. Secondly, I will go through a number of EU laws that has been adopted over the past couple of years in response to the crisis. And thirdly and lastly, and maybe most importantly, I will speak on the fiscal compact. What's in it? What role is it to play? And why should we be scared of it, basically? Now, first, a very, very brief analysis or introduction to the euro crisis. It would probably be a bit blunt, a bit schematic, but I think it's relatively easy to present a much more serious analysis than the one we are being served by our governments and by institutions like the Commission. If you ask our governments and if you ask the Commission, the ongoing crisis is mostly about lax governmental spending in the periphery of the Eurozone. It's about uncompetitive businesses in a number of countries. And the solution to this crisis will thus be to have rules on strict budgetary rules and a number of reforms to ensure that labor law do not stand in the way of competitiveness. That's the official myth. And I'm sure that the official discourse in the Netherlands is probably not that different from that of my own country, which is Denmark. I think what we've seen, what we're hearing from the European Commission and from our governments is a massive fabrication, a misrepresentation of historic dimensions of the deep crisis that we're in. I mean, if you go back just 2 years, or 2.5 years, find in the regular political debate a deep concern with government budgets in the South or anywhere else for that matter. At the time, that was not at all on the political agenda, almost not at all. What we were talking about at that point was the responsibility of financial institutions for throwing us out into a deep financial crisis. So that would be the first point that we should always remember. This crisis started with a financial breakdown caused by speculation from by many European and American financial institutions. That played out in the European scene, that played out very, very unevenly. The crisis they saw in countries like Greece and Portugal was much, much more severe than the one you saw in the Netherlands and the one we saw in Denmark, and not least the one they, the Germans felt. I think, to me and to the Danish political debate, that brought pretty strong memories back of the debate we had during a referendum on the euro 12 years ago. Back then, I think that was an excellent debate in many ways, and I think that it's one of the few occasions where the Euro project and the Economic and Monetary Union was debated so intensely in a country in the European Union. Back then, basically, there were two positions. One position would claim that inside the euro, you would, after a couple of years, see a pretty close economic convergence between the countries that would participate. That was one position. The other position was that you cannot have a common currency without some sort of common financial policy, without some sort of mechanism that ensures that the weakest parts or the poorest parts or the least competitive parts of the monetary zone receives support so as to not be outcompeted and marginalized by the core. I believe that what we've seen with the euro crisis is a confirmation that those who argued that a common currency would lead to divergence turned out to be right. That in the years before the financial crisis broke, there was a huge imbalance building up, mainly between Germany on one side and the periphery on the other, with Ireland and Portugal and Italy and Greece in the periphery. And that was, you could say, kind of a disaster waiting to happen, and the financial crisis basically just triggered an event that could have emerged dramatically in another way. Now, did that debate really emerge on the European scene when we had the euro crisis, when that started 2 years ago? Definitely not. It was immediately spinned as a result of either lax spending or lack of respect for the rules of the Economic and Monetary Union called the Stability Pact. From the very beginning of the Economic and Monetary Union, we've heard a lot from a group of economists called the Euromonetarists, who claimed, and they were very influential when the Economic and Monetary Union was built, they claimed that if only the participating countries in the monetary zone would abide by a couple of simple criteria, then we would see stability in the long term. And the criteria were, if budget deficits of a government do not exceed 3%, then they will be in the clear. If the government debt does not exceed 60%, then they will be in the clear. We never really saw that fundamental discussion on the responsibility, or could see the link between imbalances in the eurozone and the crisis at the European level. It was immediately turned into a kind of a, I would say, blame the victims debate. It was immediately turned into a problem that had to do with very internal economic problems of either Greece or Ireland or Spain. And they even turned a blind eye to the fact that just before the crisis broke, countries like Ireland and Spain were actually in the clear. They had no serious government deficit and not a very high debt. But the response, I mean, given that we never had that discussion on the significance of the imbalances in the euro, The euro crisis could easily be turned into fuel for a series of economic reforms that strong political and economic actors in Europe have been yearning for many years. And that's what we've seen over the past couple of years. And I will just go briefly through not all of them, but the most important of them. First, we have, of course, the loan programs. Two different sets of funds are in operation. There is one called the EFSF that has lent money to Ireland and to Portugal and to Greece under very, 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 very tough conditions. That will be replaced by a new fund very soon, called the European Stability Mechanism. Basically, that's a kind of a European monetary fund that will ensure that Ireland, Portugal, and Greece stick to a very, very strict neoliberal economic policy. That's the first. The second reform we've seen is something called the European Semester. Basically, the European Semester is a first major step towards a situation where member state budgets are approved in Brussels. Every April, all EU governments have to hand in not the final budget for the coming year, but the draft budget, the basic ideas of the government for next year's budget. Then, after a few months, during the ensuing months, there will be a debate in the Council and in the Commission on, well, what these actors think about the draft budgets they've seen. This system was tested last year, and by the end of June, a set of recommendations was adopted by the Council to each and every single member state. And it was made abundantly clear what this mechanism is to be used for in the coming years. In the recommendations, you would see things like Belgium should quit its indexation of wages. A number of countries were asked to reform their labor laws. A lot of countries, basically all countries, were asked to cut down on pensions. A very, very, very clear signal from the Council that once this body and the Commission gets an influence on member state budgets, it would be used to push austerity measures to some extent. So that was the European Semester. Then there's the Euro Plus Pact. The Euro Plus Pact is a political agreement between governments. It's not really a treaty. It's a kind of a musketeer's oath that in order to promote competitiveness, we promise each other that we will try to force each other to reform labor laws and to reduce minimum wages. The second thing with the Euro Plus Pact, in order to promote what they call sound public finances, we should keep in particular an eye on expenditure for health and expenditure on pensions. So much for the Euro Plus Pact. Then comes the six-pack. And usually I'm given about an hour to explain what the six-pack is about because it has a lot of teeth, and it's probably still the most important instrument that has been adopted over the past couple of years. The six-pack should be divided in two pieces. It's called the six-pack because it's six different pieces of legislation, but actually, it can be divided into two. First is that the old rules of the Stability Pact, the 3% threshold for government deficits and the 60% for government debt, has to be enforced much more strongly. Basically, it hasn't really been enforced in the past, but now it's supposed to be. And one of the things that has been adopted is that in order to start a procedure against a country that are in breach of these limits, there has to be a qualified majority in the Council against such a measure.